found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show. Current events, newsmakers, lifestyle, health, relationships, entertainment. Miss a day? Download the podcast at LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. Heard here at LA Talk Radio live weekday mornings at 9 o'clock Pacific. And then later for download at MariaSanchezShow.com and TheMariaSanchezShow.com. Thank you so much for your ears. You know there are free apps available for you to download the program to your iPhone or your Android or your tablet or what have you, so you can take us on the go. They're calling that the modern-day version of a transistor. And if you don't know what a transistor radio is, then that means that I'm older than you are. So grew up with those. On our program this morning, you know, it's summer, and that sometimes creates forced bondings. We have graduations, weddings, reunions, anniversaries, that sort of thing. And with forced bonding, sometimes that means that we're surrounded by people that are not our favorites, meaning our families of origin, or there's uncomfortable things that come out because of that situation. So our first guest is, he's known as the Doctor of Common Sense. He is going to help us with some skills about how to get along with the people that you might not want to be around, but you are around. And then later on in the broadcast, we have somebody, we always try and focus on some good news, and this is one of those stories, and also feature a nonprofit whenever possible. Our guest founded Grants to You, which is about, and this is good anywhere where there's nonprofits, soliciting volunteers to help your local favorite nonprofit, or even, it doesn't have to be local, nonprofit, with helping them to raise money through grant research and writing. So those are our guests today. Happen to see something. If you don't go out to see theater, please consider doing it. It really is a marvelous experience. You know, the thing about theater and the thing about radio that I love so much is that there's no safety net. There's no second take. It's live. What you see is unique because it'll never be recreated again, even though the words are the same and the actors may be the same or the host is the same. It's every minute means that there's something unpredictable because it's live. So got to see the world premiere of The Assassination of Leon Trotsky, a comedy that opened on Saturday night here in Los Angeles. And it was in one of those smaller theaters, like 99 seats or less. And it was unbelievable. It's about Leon Trotsky and his wife and their last days in Mexico because Stalin had kicked them out. And Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera took them in. And it's somewhat historical. And then it takes this wild tangent ride off of the truth of what had happened into this real wild world. And being a huge fan of Frida Kahlo and her art and her work and her interesting life, it was great to see that too. So I encourage you to see it if you can, and or to see what you can that's available in your area. So the Edward Snowden story doesn't go away, because over the weekend there was made public, there was a one-page complaint against him extraditing, asking for extradition. And he left yesterday Hong Kong and flew to Russia. So, you know, he's a 29-year-old guy. And whether you agree with what he did or whether you agree with what he did and how he did it, I wonder about the pressure of the world on a 29-year-old man. It's, I mean, obviously any of us. But so he is, he has three charges against him. The first charge is an embezzlement charge, theft of government property. The second charge is unauthorized communication of national defense information. And the third charge is willful communication of classified communications intelligence information to unauthorized persons. So he faces a maximum of 30 years in jail with fines, and he has to return any government materials in his possession. They're saying more charges can also be filed because the case is in active investigation. And just so you know, what he was charged under is the Espionage Act, and that has a history starting with President Woodrow Wilson in the World War I era. He asked Congress to pass the act. It was amended in 1918, and that was with the addition of the then-controversial Sedition Act amendments. And then those amendments were repealed by Congress after World War I, but the Espionage Act has remained basically in its present form. It's been amended a little bit since that time. So they think that he is working with the WikiLeaks to find a country that poses an extradition barrier to the United States, such as Ecuador, Cuba, and Venezuela are rumored destinations. He was apparently booked on a flight from Moscow to Havana today, but they say that his seat that was assigned to him wasn't taken by him, and that he's in talks with Ecuador, and apparently they're going to have a press conference today about the situation because they say they are considering his request. So the Ecuador has just 15 million people, and they're, of course, keeping Julian Assange. He's taken refuge in their embassy in London. And apparently WikiLeaks is working with Snowden to help him make his way, I guess, to safety. So I can't imagine what that pressure is like. We've got Paula Deen in the news. Again, if you missed this over the weekend, she was supposed to do an on-camera, open and candid interview with Today's Matt Lauer on Friday, and she begged off of that. She said she was exhausted after she flew to New York City. She's in the news because when she was deposed, a May 17th deposition, she claimed that she did use the N-word on occasion. And the Food Network has subsequently said that they will not renew her contract when it expires at the end of this month. And they issued a statement today that says the Food Network, quote, does not tolerate any form of discrimination and is a strong proponent of diversity and inclusion. We will continue to monitor the situation. Apparently QVC is also considering what they may or may not do. So she revealed that in her past she used racial slurs in her family life and tolerated racist jokes in the workplace. And some people are saying, hey, put it in context. She's 66 years old. When she was raised, that kind of stuff was done. It was said. It was common and vernacular. You know, cut her some slack. To her credit, she did post a video, and then she took that down and posted another one, which is the one that's available on YouTube now. And she's asking for forgiveness, and she's apologizing, which as she should do. She should be making atonement, if you will. I'm not as old as her. In fact, I'm a generation younger than she is. But I was raised, both of my parents speak English as their second language, and they were raised in a time where they were discriminated against, and they had prejudice put upon them, but they perpetrated those words. And the N-word was used. I'm not going to say a lot, but it was used. In fact, my mother used it to describe some things in life, like I can't think of the word right now, but it's like a Y-shaped device slingshot. And you would have had a rubber band, and you'd put a rock or something in it, and you'd pull it back. There was an N-word used to describe that. Brazil nuts had an N-word also describing that. I grew up where words were used to describe ethnic languages persons of a certain ethnic distinction. And I'll give an example because this came from my mother's words, because I don't use those words at all, never did. And in fact, I'm the eldest of four in my family. My folks and my siblings would laugh, and I would sit there scowling. I never, ever, ever took delight in it. It's really interesting. I'm sure people could have thought I was a sourpuss. I've got a wicked sense of humor. I really appreciate comedy. But that, to me, was never funny. It was like somebody was stabbing me every time I heard that. So my mother gives this example, that she went to college where she was raised, which was in New Mexico. She went to the University of New Mexico. She studied biology and chemistry, and she became a medical technologist, and she had to go to Yonkers, New York to do her training. Now, my mother is brilliant. She skipped three grades. She graduated from college when she was 18, I think. And she was also in a man's world, if you will, medical technology, science. So she goes to New York, and the conversation comes up amongst her colleagues, like, what are you? And she said, well, I'm an American. And they go, well, no, what's your ethnic background? And she says, I'm Spanish. And this is before Hispanic. And they said, oh, you're a Spic. And she says, what's that? And they said, that's Spanish. And so she didn't know that it was derogatory, so she was innocent. And so when people would ask her, what is she? She would say she was a Spic. And she used to call my dad, who was German, that kind of a name too. So I grew up with it. There's no reason for it, especially in this day and age, especially in the workplace, especially, you know, when you're in the media and you have people that follow you, idolize you, magnify you. No, not going to work. So I'm sorry that she had those things to admit to, and I actually admire the Food Network for jettisoning and distancing themselves from her. So now we're speaking with Dr. Michael Finkelstein, who has written a book about communications with difficult situations and how we can make it. Hi, Dr. Finkelstein. It's Maria Sanchez. Good morning, and thank you for joining the Maria Sanchez Show this morning.
You're welcome, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
And so it's funny how not to fight with your family. Some people think that you can't get around that, that it's just inherent because they know what buttons to push. They know your Achilles heel. They might not even do it deliberately, but they just can't help themselves. And in this time of graduations and weddings and reunions and anniversaries, there's not an opportunity necessarily to avoid those situations. So I'm curious to hear how you think that we can get around some of these decades-old known behaviors and make a difference in how we communicate.
Well, I think I have two ideas that could be really useful. The first is to see it in a way just like you said, which is, in other words, it serves a point. Families are connected with each other for a number of reasons, some of which may just be luck or bad luck, but we have our families. We're born into them. And rather than to see everything as an aggravation and a fight, maybe to look at the process as somehow necessary for us to evolve further, to be better human beings, and that these people who really push our buttons are not, you know, our thorns in our side and our enemies, but are really almost our best friends in a way, and they're force us to face to look at other things. So if we see it from a perspective of there's value in it, the next question is, well, what can I learn? What kind of value would there be in this aggravation? And the other then, which is the second half of my comment, is to not take things, therefore, as personally, and to not carry your past into your present. That's what we all can probably learn to do. In other words, we hold on to those things from the past gathering, and all we have to do is somebody says, do you remember that time? And then the past is brought to the present, and we're back to where we were. And if we can stop that vicious cycle just by ourselves making that effort to say, I'm not going to go there, I'm going to say, go into a next conversation or say that was the past and I'm going to look at the present, which is the graduation of our niece. Let's really enjoy the moment, and I think it's a beautiful day and you look good, by the way. Those are the ways we could get out of the past.
Now, why is it that we let people get under our skin? Because what you say makes so much common sense. There should be no conflict in the world if we could do what you've just suggested.
You're right. So I think there's value in this under our skin phenomenon. In other words, I think anything that happens in nature, and we tend to label things good and bad, and in this case we probably will label them bad, but maybe we don't have to label it bad. Maybe there's something good trying to happen. So that gives you our opportunities. The mirror gets turned around. We're looking at ourselves. We're looking at our past. And we have this golden moment, this opportunity to say, I don't have to step back into that. And so that this is the inherent value. And so, yeah, it happens. We've got these buttons. People know where they are. However, I think this is our golden moment to just let our buttons go.
Now, I have seen, and I can't personally attest to this, but I've seen where there's bad blood between people, and it's not necessarily family, but usually it is, that it's oil and water. They just don't mm-hmm. like each other. They really can barely even tolerate one another. You see it in their body language and their demeanor, even in how they communicate. So are you to remove yourself from that person so you don't have to worry about a potential exchange, or how can you get beyond what is bad chemistry?
Well, that's true. Sometimes you do have to remove yourself. But the other way of removing yourself, if you're forced to be present, is to come into your own center. You know, so a practice like meditation or being in good shape, meaning mentally, emotionally, physically, where you feel really good about yourself, means that you're going to be moved from your center with a lot greater force, meaning you won't get so moved from your center by this cousin that you don't really like seeing. So that the idea here is to get into a state of equanimity, a state of balance. And when you're in a better state of balance, you're essentially removed. Occasionally, however, you just have to avoid it. I mean, sometimes it's just so bad that the greater part of valor is to avoid it. And that is sometimes good advice.
Because I've noticed in my family of origin, I'm the oldest of four, that I have changed. I've evolved from the young girl and the young woman that I was, and I'm not perfect, certainly, but I'm not. I have softened my rough edges, if you will. I used to be just brutally blunt because I didn't know. I just only speak the truth. Then I realized you can still speak the truth, but you don't have to hurt feelings, or you might want to couch your words a little bit differently and not use action words or that sort of thing.
Right.
But what I found is my family still thinks of me as who I was. So they expect me to be that person, and when I'm not, they look at me like, even my father, 6 years ago, my sister was getting married, and something was awry, and the ceremony was delayed, and we were just milling about, and my dad comes up to me, and he says, you need to fix it. And I said, why? And he goes, because that's what you do. And I said, no, it's not my problem. And so I saw this look on his face like, what? You've always been the one that rushes to rescue. And so it was difficult to stay centered in that person that I am today, because here's my dad asking of me. But my point being is that he still expected the behavior that I once exhibited that I no longer do.
Right. Well, there's in every family, there's usually the first adapter, the person who really starts evolving and getting very conscious. And so in the midst of a moment like that, it's very hard to sort of make a dent. However, this might be an opportunity for you to, at some later date, when it's calm, when there's nothing specific going on, to sort of call a family meeting and to say, you know, we could all be here and relive our past every time we connect, or we can sort of see that we have the purpose of helping each other and we can have a collective conscious evolution, if you will, if we put our minds to it and agree that we don't all have to always go back to the past roles and the assumptions that we've lived with all these years, and lead the way in this movement with your family to sort of bring everyone up by the bootstraps and to really advance. It can have a great effect at a calm moment to sort of get everyone on that same page. Now, of course, people will still have their, triggers, and they will still fall backwards, but implanting the suggestion can make a big difference over time. And then all you have to do when it comes up again at the next affair is say, do you remember the conversation we had in July? We could actually stop ourselves from going back to this and really see ourselves as growing, maturing individuals, all of us, and treat each other with a little bit greater respect. I think that could work. And that's what I would suggest. In my book, in fact, 77 Questions for Skillful Living, the dedication is not to the individual reading the book, but to our collective conscious evolution. My hope is that when people get into this work, that they see that it's not only about me, but it's about all of us. And if I could support the others around me, then I actually get the support that I need. And it works very well that way.
Well, and of course, you're probably suggesting that change creates change, and that no one act goes unnoticed, the ripple effect with the pebble in the pond sort of thing. And I've actually seen that in my family of origin, because we all have big personalities, and so when we and then the baggage that we bring forward, there was always some drama whenever we got together, always. And now we're actually drama free. And even my kids and I will talk about it after the fact. We had a big family reunion when my mom turned 80 in February of this year. Not one issue. Nobody stomped out. Nobody raised their voice. Nobody threw a scene. And it's like, wow, and that's 19 of us. So it is possible. Yeah.
Yes. And that's wonderful when it happens. So somebody can take the initiative with that. So the people listening to your show right now could say, this holiday season, let's say, for July 4th, whatever's coming up, the summer vacations, the next opportunity I have, I'm going to have this sort of meeting of minds, and I'm going to lead the way with this thought that in love, we're going to really support each other. We all have stories, and we all have wounds, but we could agree to sort of do, each of us do our part, and to give each other a little bit more of a break so that we can move forward and really enjoy these amazing moments, like the 80th birthday of our parents.
Now, how evolved emotionally, though, do people have to be to have that kind of communication or have that awareness? I would imagine you're speaking about a percentage of us, not the majority of us.
You know what? There are very few people I meet who don't have the intention to grow and be better.
Mm.
You know, in terms, so very few people. So I think everyone could just take that one step forward, that just, you know, bury the hatchet for the minute. And if everyone just did a little bit on that level, what kind of effect would that be as we sort of pool our collective energies? And so everyone can do this. I believe, I mean, maybe the most reticent and the hardest and the most, you know, angry individual may have a hard time with this, but even those individuals I've met sort of have a desire in some way to find the key to unlock this goodness. And I would say everyone can do it.
How important, Dr. Finkelstein, is it for forgiveness to be a part of this process?
That's critical. And you know who you start with? Yourself. We can't be perfect. We should never be, like you were saying with your story with your father. If we can always be expected to perform a certain way, even when that's very old and that's not really you anymore, we are trying to occasionally live up to that standard. We get down on ourselves first. So let's forgive the person that we can't be because that was sort of just a flash in the pan, brilliant, you know, when we were seven. We can't maintain that standard. So let's just be nice to ourselves. And then let's look at all the people around us, starting with our parents and our siblings, spouses, children, you know, best friends, and say, look, everyone is on some sort of journey, and there's a lot of pain on that journey. And we can just be a little bit more humble and not expect them to be so perfect either, and just say, is there something inside of them that I really do like or appreciate? Let me lead with that. That's how we do it. So, yes, forgiveness, which to me is another way of saying let go of the past.
Mm-hmm. Now, what happens if there are emotions that weren't resolved and somebody has passed away?
Well, then you could write. Even, you know, you can create art. You could express that emotion, and maybe they will not hear it. A lot of people won't believe that, you know, somehow people on the other side, you know, can understand what's going on now. But why not take a chance at that actually happening? I think most people who do that feel better. So writing is the simplest thing to do. Write a letter to the person you have something to say, and see how you feel afterwards. Whether they really hear it or not may be secondary to how you feel. Again, it's about your life and you moving forward.
Because I understand that when we forgive, we do release, and that means that we're not in the past and we have an opportunity to be in the now and live and move forward unencumbered, if you will.
Exactly.
Now, you are a board-certified internist and a certified holistic physician, and you founded the Skillful Living concept. I love the fact that you're an East-West kind of a guy. And
well,
how did that come about?
Well, my desire all along was to be the best doctor I could be. And after 20 years of medical practice in a conventional way, I said to myself, you know, I could probably do better than this. The system that I had been trained in is good at certain things, but not good at many things. So it's not good between doctor's visits, helping people live their lives, to appreciate the positive, even in states of pain. And so I decided to go back and study other systems that focused on living, not fear of dying or pain or disease. And there are many other models of that type of practice all over the world, and we often label them as Eastern. But the fact is, Native Americans have been practicing that on our shores ever since they inhabited this continent. So yes, they are somewhat more Eastern because that's how they've been reintroduced now and become a little bit more popular. But the fact is, this holism is universal, and it has always existed in time. In fact, way before the first microscope, all doctors were holistic.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are just getting reacquainted with that. I'm just trying to take the best of what's out there and offer that to people. And so in my practice, I sort of evolved, and now I have a lot more tools in my toolbox.
And in terms of the holistic side, what does that involve? Meditation, yoga, herbs, that sort of thing? Is that how you identify
it? Yes and no, but I think honestly, even though those are all the things you mentioned are very important, I would probably almost universally recommend them in some form. The idea is first a perspective, is to appreciate what is health. Health is not how our body functions only. Health is not only about are we successful and how long we live. Health is about the quality of our relationships, how we feel about ourselves, whether we are okay with the end of life. When we achieve states of balance and perspective that allow us to really be in the moment, then actually that's how we're healthy. So those are tools that you recommend, and if that helps you get there, then they're valuable. But there are many more tools. But the first thing is perspective, is that redefinition of health. Understand where you're going with all this work, your purpose in life. Why do you care about being healthy? This is the beginning of the question set that I ask people to reorient them so that whatever then you put on board, whatever you enjoy or you appreciate or you respect in terms of a modality or a function makes sense to you, and then you connect all the dots.
And how and where does gratitude fit in your scale of things?
Oh, that's part of the perspective. We need to appreciate the fact that we have this opportunity in life. So that first question I ask in my book really is, what's your purpose? Why are you here? What are you going to do with this blessing of living that you have? Because without that, why would your body, your subconscious mind lose weight? Why would you be healthy? Why would your blood pressure come down? Why could you get off the medication? Because if you don't know where you're going, one, it's hard to do the work, and two, subconsciously and unconsciously, your body will defeat you. If you're spinning around, not sure why you do anything, well, why not have more pizza tonight? This is the orientation, the goal has to be clear. And so that's where people, to me, need to start thinking of where they're really going, not their cholesterol, not their blood pressure, not just their weight. These are all factors that are of some value, but it's where are you really going. If I was a magician, I can wave a wand and fix everyone's body, I'd still ask that question. So now what are you going to do?
And do affirmations fit in under that exploration?
To some extent. I think affirmations have become a little popularized and hokey and a product you can buy. Yes, I think it's good to think positively. I think it's good to be grateful. But I don't think we should expect that repeating a particular phrase will get us what we want if what we are saying we want is really not substantially valuable, not only to ourselves but to all the people around us. So I think a lot of people have taken this affirmation concept and applied it to short-term goals, and I don't know that those would work.
And then finally, talk about your syndicated radio program, The Skillful Living Room.
Essentially what I try to do is to spend an hour with a guest talking about quality of life. Yes, it's got a little bit of a medical health spin to it, but it's really about giving people an hour of radio time that's pleasant, that might be inspiring, that will give some information, but it's not so content-heavy that it's mind-boggling. It's meant to give people a breath. Mm-hmm. We have so much information crossing our path. We need an hour of the day, probably every day, not just listening to radio, but in peace. And what's often on the airwaves are things that are aggravating and upsetting. So I try to avoid that and provide content for people, and so that they can hear what I think is rational, filled with common sense, a certain amount of wisdom, and is ultimately practical.
Which is how our paths cross, because I ascribe to the same thing. If at all possible, mm-hmm. I want to have good news be broadcast, inspirational
yes.
stories, and things that are uplifting and allow us to dream and to achieve, and et cetera. So I guess there was a reason that we're having this conversation this morning.
And I appreciate it.
Me
really
too.
Do.
And so we will post Dr. Michael Finkelstein, on our website when we post the podcast. And anything else you'd like to add about your 77 questions for skillful living?
No, I just hope it helps everyone. And drmichaelfinkelstein.com is my email address, my website. And, of course, I'm open to anyone emailing me. I'm happy to hear from people and guide them personally if I can as well.
Thank you so much, and continued success.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Maria. Be well.
And you as well. Good luck with the book, too. So you see, how funny is that we both ascribe to the same kinds of things, which is there's obviously a nerve that we're hitting because it is, I mean, yes, there's news, and we can't ignore that, and there's bad news, and unfortunately that happens. When I get on and do research for the program and I hear and see some of these stories, I'm like, oh, I can't believe it, you know, man's inhumanity to man or what have you, or bad luck or that sort of thing, but we don't have to focus on it. And the other thing that what I've been told by other folks that are in that kind of business, that the attitude of gratitude is a lot. And I've been told that stress and gratitude are impossible to coexist in the brain at the same time. So that was redundant, coexist in the same time. So that if you find that you're feeling stressed or stressed out, or it's how you react to it. One of our guests said last week, stress is not external, it's internal. It's how you manifest itself. It's how you bring it in or not. So if you find that you are feeling stressed, if you default to what are you grateful for, and I always default to I'm grateful for my four children, I'm grateful for my health and wellness, I'm grateful for this opportunity, I'm grateful for my skills and my talents and that all that sort of thing. And then the next thing I know, I'm like, I'm a little happy-go-lucky anyway, as it will. Before we get to our next guest, we get the luxury of some more news. So Nick Walenda, who is part of the Flying Walendas, a seventh-generation member of the family of acrobats, made history yesterday. He walked on a 2-inch steel cable over the Grand Canyon. He describes himself as the king of the high wire. It took him 22 minutes and 54 seconds to walk 1,400 feet across the Little Colorado River, Grand Canyon. The event was broadcast live around the world on the Discovery Channel because he had cameras affixed to his body. He held a 43-pound balancing pole. He crouched down twice, once because of the wind and the second because the cable had picked up an unsettling rhythm. And he says, this is what my family has done for 200 years, so it's a part of my legacy. He's 34 years old. It was watched live in 217 countries. And what's poignant about the story is that his great-grandfather, Carl Walenda, slipped and fell to his death from a high wire in Puerto Rico in 1978. He trained in his Florida town of Sarasota, and he's also the one that walked across the Niagara Falls, and his next stunt is what he'd like to do. He would like to walk between New York's Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building. Now, talk about an adrenaline junkie. So it made the news over the weekend, but it's still in the news now because the biggest and the brightest full moon of the year is the moon, obviously, and it is closer to the planet Earth than usual. It's going to appear 14% larger and 30% brighter than normal, and they're calling it the supermoon. But it's going to last until at least tomorrow. So the phrase supermoon was coined in 1979 by astrologer Richard Noel. He used the term to describe a new or full moon that occurs when the moon is at or near its closest approach to Earth. So this there's an even larger one expected on September 28th, 2015. The largest supermoon is going to be in November of 2016. So if you get a chance, go and see it. And Saturday night at the theater, there was an intermission, and so I went outside to get some fresh air and, of course, check my phone. And there I'm looking up at the sky, and it's like unbelievable. And it reminded me, I used to have a best girlfriend who we would celebrate a full moon once a month. And we would go to the beach, and we would share a bottle of champagne, and then we would howl at the moon, and then we would go skinny dipping in the ocean. And we did that month in and month out. And it was just this natural, like, you know, acknowledging Mother Earth and everything else, and having a great friend with you and doing something unusual. And skinny dipping in the ocean at night is not something that I would ordinarily do, but we gave the excuse of the full moon to make it. Okay, Hostess is in the news because Twinkies are coming back next month. Hostess says that they're going to have Twinkies and other snack cakes back on the shelves starting July 15th, and they're expecting a blockbuster return. They are also going to be offering cupcakes and donuts. And the company says the cakes will taste the same, but the boxes will now bear the tagline, quote, the sweetest comeback in the history of ever. So they had problems with their workers that were unionized, and they had to close their doors. About 15,000 unionized workers lost their jobs. And another something that they're going to do is they're going to deliver to warehouses that supply retailers rather than delivering directly to stores, which they say is going to greatly expand their reach, which means that you can get them at more places, because previously they were only able to reach about a third of the country's 150,000 convenience stores. They've also streamlined their production. It's been consolidated from 11 bakery plants to 4. one each in Georgia, Kansas, Illinois, and Indiana. The headquarters were moved from Texas to Kansas City, Missouri, where Hostess had previously based and still had some accounting offices. They're making a little bit of change in the cupcakes. The company is using dark cocoa instead of milk chocolate, they say, to give them a richer, darker appearance, and that the changes were made to improve the cakes, not to cut costs. Prices for the cakes are going to remain the same. A box of 10 Twinkies will cost $3.99, and they are debating the shelf life. The fable that says that they last for forever, they say 45 days, that's it. They don't last forever. I don't think I've ever bought a Twinkie. I know that I had Twinkies when I was growing up, but that was something that when my children were given sweets, it was home-baked stuff because I love to bake, and now my kids are taking over. It's so funny. They're sampling with chocolate chip cookie recipes, and when they were over, I think it was 2 weeks ago, I said, well, would you like the recipe that you were raised on? And I actually have a recipe box, and I pulled it out, and it is tattered and worn, and the ink is fading because of water droplets on it. So my second son, who's really into it, he took a picture of the front and the back on his iPhone, and then they used the recipe, and they said it was pretty good, but it still needs some fine-tuning. So now we're speaking with Paul Baskin, who has created something a while ago called Grants to You, and it's to utilize volunteers to help nonprofits raise money.
Paul, may I help you?
Hi, Paul. Good morning. You're on live with Maria Sanchez. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Paul Baskin founded Grants to You, which was formerly Grants for You, in 2001. So you've been at it for a while. Give our listeners an overview of what it is that you are doing and how they can become involved in helping. And again, I see this as a win-win-win. So it's another good news story that people get to volunteer their strengths and their talents to a nonprofit that they happen to care about, which is benefiting people, so everyone's winning.
You're exactly right. We actually started in 2001 right here in Camarillo, and our goal was to get those executives or retired child rearers or whatever out of their couches, off the golf courses, and spend a few minutes every month helping their favorite local nonprofit raise grant money for their operations.
So how do you go about that? First of all, you have to solicit folks, and then you have to assess their skills and or their inclinations. And then do you train them or standardize their training, or how does it work?
Well, we actually form chapters around the country, and then each chapter works hard to promote their chapter and promote the idea of coming to our class. Folks who want to come to our class register online, and the system asks them a number of questions about their skill sets.
Mm, okay.
Ultimately, the system says, what nonprofit are you willing to assist, and what is their contact information? When the person completes the registration, an email goes out to the nonprofit of their choice telling that nonprofit that they have a volunteer to help.
So the chapters have a particular nonprofit that they focus on?
No, actually the individuals do.
So
what I'm trying to say is our volunteers pick their own.
Right, but the volunteers form a chapter, and then the chapter picks a nonprofit.
No, the chapter is formed by a chapter coordinator, a volunteer, and we have them all over the country. One chapter coordinator per chapter, and that chapter coordinator's job is to do the promotion, make sure the class goes off correctly, finds a proper teacher to teach the class, and works with the newspapers and the other nonprofits in the community.
So when you have a chapter, you're a group of interested volunteers who have skill sets that they'd like to share, and then they do standardized training that you provide.
And, yes.
And then they identify a nonprofit, or do they take
No, they identify a nonprofit right up front.
Okay.
Right when they register. If they don't have a nonprofit of their choice and choose to select one, we're unable to train them. So we only train volunteers. That's the bottom line of this program. It's all about volunteers. And since 2001, over 840 have been trained.
So, Paul,
and those volunteers have helped to win over $2 million, but they're selected nonprofits.
I would think that the nonprofits would want to know about you because most nonprofits already have a base of volunteers.
They do and they don't, but the point that you made is true. Every nonprofit in Ventura County needs to know about Grants to You just as so many know, in Prescott, Arizona, where we just came from. Here in Ventura County, there are 2,700 nonprofits. We need all of them to say, yes, we need that help. And by the way, we'll send you a volunteer so they can take your class and help us with our grant writing. That's the kind of relationship we need to build here.
So, and obviously this applies anywhere, in the country at least, that if there's a group of people who want to help a nonprofit, you're giving them the skill set to be able to do it, to actually help with the grant writing, which ultimately raises money.
Yes, but it isn't a group of people. It's just one person at a time. So when we have a class, we usually have a class every quarter, and we typically like to attract about 15 volunteers. These volunteers come from all over. They do or do not know each other, but they all have one thing in common. They want to volunteer to help a local nonprofit of their choice.
And do you teach them how to write grants?
Yes. We teach them how to research grants, how to write a letter of intent, and how to write a grant.
And if people don't know, and it's likely that they don't, what is grant writing and what are grants? Can you share that?
Yes. For those who don't know, grants are, let's call them funds that come from private foundations. An example of a private foundation would be the Bill Gates Foundation, mm-hmm. where Mr. Gates has put substantial amounts of money into a fund that is available for certain reasons and certain reasons only. So what we teach people to do is find foundations, and there are hundreds of thousands of them, find foundations that have a certain kind of mission statement that matches the mission statement of their favorite nonprofit. And when we have a match, that's a good one to connect with, to call, to write to send a letter of intent, and so on.
So give us an example that Grants for You has done specifically.
Well, Grants for You has, as I said, people have raised over $2 million working with our volunteers. For example, in Prescott, Arizona, the HOA there in Hidden Valley Ranch won a grant for $183,000 to improve its facilities for its citizens. Just as an example, in Saratoga Springs, New York, a student won $500,000 to build a medical school in Rwanda.
Wow.
Just to name a few.
Wow.
In Prescott, again, Youth Count, which is an organization that is about youth, raised 313 grants for over $50,000 for youth causes. The Elks Opera House won $35,000. And by the way, that one was won by a 92-year-old woman who took our class.
So what Paul is saying is that, let's say that you want to help animals get rescued and adopted. So that's something that you want to contribute to. There are foundations that are specifically set up that's one of the causes that they want to champion. So you're saying you take a need that exists and you identify a foundation that wants to fill that need, and you put the two together through your grant request.
Yes.
So
through the research first.
Right.
So you find the best possible opportunity, and then followed by a letter of intent, or even before that, perhaps a phone call, just to identify yourself to that party, say howdy, as they like to say, always say howdy, and once they get to know you and they see your letter of intent, they say, aha, that's the person, and so forth. You build a relationship with the nonprofit organization, and you build a relationship with the foundation people.
Now, there are...
Recently, I talked to Wells Fargo, and they fund grants to you to a great extent, and they said, we're so happy that you call us. We're so happy to hear your voice and that you connect with us. So that's a lesson learned.
Well, and Wells Fargo, when I was with the American Red Cross as the director of development, I was always impressed with how philanthropic they are and all different kinds of avenues that they pursue, including their employees. They allow their employees to make a request of a personal passion that they have, and they sometimes match that on that level, let alone on corporate levels.
Well, you're quite right. Wells Fargo is very philanthropic. As a matter of fact, some years ago when we first met with them, they used to have a program where they not only accepted your application, they came out to your nonprofit. They actually traveled to wherever you are reviewed your systems, reviewed your office, and so forth. And then if you won a grant, they invited you to a luncheon in Phoenix, Arizona, where you were asked to accept an award, accept money, and make a speech.
Nice.
And that was really, really fun and exciting.
Nice.
Since then, I think they've dropped that particular process and gone to something more economical, but they're still funding grants to you every single year, and we're so grateful that they're doing that.
So, Paul, how does someone avail themselves of what Grants to You has to offer?
The best way is to learn something about us, and that means going to grantstoyou.org.
Okay.
That's our website.
And what's the reason?
The website is loaded with information about who we are, what we do, how we do it, and all the contact information they could ever want. But if anybody wants to call me, I'm the founder and I'm the elected president, and my phone number is 805-419-4599. And email info@grantstoyou.org.
And we'll post that information later when we post the podcast. Paul, and what was the reason that you started Grants to You?
I was working with nonprofits. I was on the board of 9 nonprofits right here in Ventura County, right after my retirement from Haas Automation. And it occurred to me that there were so many retirees here, so many who did not know what to do with themselves, so many who couldn't play golf and who didn't enjoy trips that much. So many of those people. And I figured we needed to have them to help communities everywhere. That's what we began.
It's a great philosophy. And how do you get the word out, Paul?
We use every means possible that doesn't cost money. Newspapers, radio stations, this interview, for example. Any means that we can. We talk with the Community Foundation in Ventura. We talk with the United Way in Ventura. We get out there and shake hands and say howdy. Now, I haven't been here for 11 years, so I've got to catch up here, and I'm doing that right now.
Excellent. Paul, thank you so much for your time. You're a perfect story for our program. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Paul Baskin, and he's the founder. And again, we are open and amenable to all kinds of programming. We have an eclectic and diverse slate. Tomorrow is a perfect example of how we've got folks on the program that does your salad know what time it is and what to do about that. That's a study that was just published. And the lead researcher is going to be visiting with us. And then we also have one of the first gay Lutheran ministers who was appointed to a higher post. He's visiting with us. That's tomorrow. He was at the White House last week, invited by President Obama to celebrate gay, lesbian, transgender, GLBT, bisexual, for the month of June is in that regard. So please feel free to log on to our website, mariasanchezshow.com, or our blog, themariasanchezshow.com. My contact information is there, and as I said, we're totally amenable to, if it's of interest, then we're going to make some time for it. So another story in the news today, as I said this morning when I tweeted this, it was like, another day, another study. Eating 2 large meals a day yields more weight loss than consuming 6 mini meals with the same number of calories. So this was presented yesterday at the American Diabetes Association meeting in Chicago. And it's a study over 12 weeks. People with type 2 diabetes who ate just breakfast and lunch lost an average of 1.25 points in their body mass index, or the BMI, compared with a loss of 0.82 points for those who ate 6 smaller meals of the same nutritional and energy content. So this is building and disproving the theory that eating more frequently improves weight loss. What I would like to point out, though, is it's breakfast and lunch, and that's a long time until your next meal. So, but there is that adage about eat breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, and dinner like a pauper. And so this has been going on over the weekend. And they're saying that eating earlier in the day, just breakfast between 6 a.m. and 10 a.m., and then lunch between 12 p.m. and 4 p.m. is associated with better results than skipping breakfast. 2 meals a day also led to a greater decrease in liver fat content and a bigger increase in insulin sensitivity than 6 smaller meals a day did. This is Maria Sanchez. Thank you so much for listening to the program. We'll leave you with our jingle. Have a great day. Look forward to seeing and visiting with you mañana.